New York is the 2nd of June 2006, approximately 1 p.m. Interviewers are Wayne Clark and Mike Russert. Could you give me your full name, date of birth, and place of birth, please?
Well, my name is John Doherty Alden. Branch of Services, U.S. Navy.
Okay, when and where were you born?
Born in San Diego, 1921.
Okay. What was your educational background prior to entering service?
Well, I was in college at the time I signed up at the Cornell University. And I signed up immediately after Pearl Harbor, as soon as they established the V-7 unit at the school. Mm-hmm. I did finish up, graduated. They called us in about a month ahead of normal graduation, but my group all got their degrees. Mm-hmm.
Now, what was a V-7 unit?
V-7 was a program that you signed up as an apprentice seaman in the Naval Reserve, unpaid, and you were allowed to finish your degree. Mm-hmm. And then you go on into active duty.
Okay, well, now why did you pick the Navy?
Well, I was in a Navy family. My father had been in the Navy. I just always interested in the Navy. And I see.
I'm going to go back a little bit. Where were you when you heard about Pearl Harbor?
I was right at the university. Mm-hmm. I guess we were studying or loafing or something a Sunday afternoon, and I heard the news on the radio. Hard to believe it. Mm-hmm.
Did you know where Pearl Harbor was at all?
Oh, sure.
Did you? Okay.
Yeah, I'd lived in Hawaii.
Oh, okay. So a lot of people had never even heard of it. But,
oh, yeah.
Okay. When you left Cornell, then you went right into the Navy. Where did
they immediately sent us to a midshipman school, mm-hmm. which was a 3-month school. And I was sent down to Columbia University in New York City. And while I was there, after the first month, you apprentice seaman. And then if you passed that part, you became a midshipman for the next 2 months. Well, just about the time I had become a midshipman, I got real sick and was sent to the hospital and was there so long I fell behind the class. So I got sent to up to Notre Dame to another midshipman school. So that's where I finished up and got commissioned.
Okay. Where did you go from after you became a midshipman?
I kept applying for submarine duty, but when I got out of Notre Dame, they sent me back to Cornell, to Diesel School, which was the last place in the world I wanted to go. But anyway, I was back there for about 5 months and went through the course in diesel engineering and then finally got ordered to submarine school. Mm-hmm. So it's just been one school after another. And while I was at New London, I got there about, it must have been a month before the next sub-school class was going to start. So they put me right on the submarine where I got some real good experience. And then I went into sub-school for 3 months, and then I stood high enough that I got my first choice, a duty, which was to a new submarine out in Manitowoc, Wisconsin. And that one was not going to be commissioned for another month or so, so they put me on another school boat out in New London. So I got real good good initial training working with, it happened to be a boat that was training prospective commanding officers. So I met a lot of people back from the Pacific that had plenty of experience. Then, while I was at sub-school, my wife and I got married. We drove out to Manitowoc and joined the crew of the submarine out there, the Lamprey, and finally went into commission. We trained on Great Lakes, And then they put the boat down through the Chicago Drainage Canal and Mississippi River down to New Orleans. And from there we went to down through the Panama Canal, did some more advanced training there, and out to Pearl Harbor, a little more training, and on to Saipan, stopped and topped off fuel, and then finally got off into the war zone.
Now when was that approximately?
By then it was early 1945. It was about March before we finally got out into the, really into the war zone.
Now, what were your duties on the submarine?
I was a communications officer on that one. Mm-hmm. Communications and electronics. Mm-hmm.
Now, were there any problems with the Lamprey at all? With it being a new boat, were there any problems at all?
It was a very well-built sub, and we didn't, I don't remember any problems at all, really. Other than, well, you always had normal problems. Mm-hmm. We had, well, as a story, you know, we would do our deep, initial deep dive out on Lake Michigan, which was pretty deep. Deep dive, you get down to 600 feet. And inspecting team had come from the East Coast, from New London. And when you get down that deep, there's always some leakage around things. There's a little seepage coming around the periscope mast or radar mast or one of those. And the commander from the Groton reached up. Fresh water. It's condensation. So that's what it probably was anyway. It was a little different diving in fresh water.
Yes.
You had to re-ballast the boat when you got into salt water.
Uh-huh. Oh, okay.
Yeah. So anyway,
what was your first patrol like?
First patrol, our skipper was an experienced older man that had had a previous boat. And they did this deliberately to take the initial first patrol. By that time of the war, they put an experienced, more conservative type officer in charge to break the crew in. And we went from Saipan, we went just north of the Philippines, between the Philippine Islands and Formosa, and did primarily lifeguard duty at first. And then they sent us...
Now, what do you mean by lifeguard duty?
Well, that's when the bombers were, mm-hmm. were flying from Saipan and Guam, the shuttles up to Japan, heavy bombing, and if they had to ditch, they had submarines stationed all along. At that time of the war, that was the main duty for subs, because they pretty well wiped off the Japanese merchant ships.
Did you ever have to pick up any downed flyers?
No, they didn't ditch near us.
Okay.
I would talk to them on the voice radio when they went over.
Mm-hmm.
I think we heard one that was down, but it was not in our area. But of course, that's where George Bush got picked up when he went down. So from there, we went down into the South China Sea. We went in close to Hong Kong. Didn't ever spot anything except a bunch of fishing junks. And then we were ordered down through the Java Sea and down to Fremantle, Australia, Western Australia. And there we had a two-week rest period, and I got a new captain, a young fellow, more aggressive. And got some new equipment, constantly getting new equipment during the war, replacing the deck guns with better ones, or replacing the electronics, improving it. So we went back up through Karamata Strait to Lombok Strait first, which was between the islands of Bali and Lombok. It's a very narrow strait. And there's quite a current. It's always coming down through it, a tidal current. And the Japanese on both sides, so submarines, as we came down from the north, we just coasted through underwater. But going up in the northerly direction, we had to stay on the surface in order to have enough speed or power to overcome that current. So it was a kind of a tricky place. And a little after, we went through another boat that got lost there. Japanese airplane. So we then went up into the Java Sea, and that was our patrol area. One of the first things we encountered, we were off of Batavia. They don't call it Batavia anymore, but that's what it was then. And we encountered a small Japanese ship. It turned out it was a submarine chaser, and we chased it. As we were shooting at it, another one of our subs popped up right next by. It turned out it was the Bluefish. And we exchanged calls with them, of course. And we were both firing at this little Japanese sub chaser. Both claimed to have hit it, but he turned tail and went away. And anyway, while we were there shooting at him, this was another one of the more interesting occasions we had. Our captain was up on the bridge, and where the deck phone was, and the executive officer was in the conning tower, and I was in the conning tower at the radar. Actually, my battle station was the assistant torpedo data computer operator, the one that controlled torpedoes. It had nothing to do with the guns. And anyway, we were watching. You could see the shells on the radar. You could track them. And our exec was getting kind of... He says, what are we doing, Captain? And are we hitting them or something like that? And Captain says, well, Bill, he's shooting back. Well, some of them are going over us, and some of them are falling short. Let's get the hell out of here. That was not a very good position to be in, really. Anyway, that was the sole gun experience I had. The only other one on that same patrol, we followed some kind of a Japanese ship. We weren't sure what it was. It might have been a DE or a landing ship of some sort. Anyway, we kept chasing him, and he went up a river in Borneo, and we finally went in backwards and shot three torpedoes out of his stern tubes, but we missed him. That's all we did. We were chasing anti-submarine ships instead of the other way around. That's all it was. The only other action we had, we stopped a number of junks and small, mostly native craft. If they had anything that looked like Japanese goods on them, we'd take the people off and sink them. But we did sink a couple of them. Mm-hmm. Okay, so they were just tiny little ships.
Now, how long?
Then we had to get rid of the crew, of course. We'd either put them into an empty boat that we stopped, the one that had room, or in the case of the one we did shoot and sink, we took the natives. I think they were probably all Chinese rather than, they were not Japanese, but they were hauling stuff that was considered contraband. We took them in as close as we could get to the shore of Borneo and put them on life jackets and sent them in.
Now, how long would a patrol last?
Well, the first one lasted almost, a little over 60 days. That would be about a normal patrol. Mm-hmm. But then you began to run out of food. That was the main limitation. If you hadn't run across any targets and shot off your torpedoes, there was no reason to go back.
What about refueling? How often did you have to do that?
We never ran low on fuel. I read our patrol report and saw how much we burned, an awful lot of gallons. But we could easily stay out 90 days with the fuel. And that would be normal kind of running, not a lot of high-speed running.
Now, what was the longest that you could stay under a diesel?
Well, we
now, you had snorkels by this time, right?
No, we didn't.
Oh, you
snorkels,
didn't?
No. We didn't. The U.S. didn't bother putting snorkels in until after the war. There was no need for them. We'd be down all during the day, so that would be maybe 14 hours or so in the tropics. Then the air began to get a little stale.
Mm-hmm.
And that. But that's nowhere near the endurance. Submarines that were held down with depth charging stayed down a lot longer than that. And stayed down until it got pretty bad. But we'd notice the air getting foul, and the pressure would build up inside the submarine just because of air leakage and things. And they open the hatch, and the air goes whoosh. And then the air, to me, it smelled like ozone, the fresh air, almost kind of a sickish smell until you got back used to it again.
Now, what kind of depths did you cruise at?
Well, normally we were probably just a periscope depth, which would be 62 feet. Mm-hmm. So we go down to 100 feet or so. There was no need to go deep. We never ran across any real Japanese warships, or we were never bombed.
Mm-hmm.
So we didn't have to go deep to escape. We'd go down to make a test dive. What we'd do, we had an instrument called the bathythermograph, which would make a trace of the temperature versus depth, so you'd know whether you had a layer under a layer of cold water underneath. Well, that was always a desirable thing.
Why?
Well, if you were attacked, you'd get down in the layer and they couldn't find you. The layer would reflect the surface ship sonar, and you'd be much harder to find if you were trying to escape. So we would make a deep dive, probably down to 400 feet every day, just to get that bathythermograph trace. But other than that, normal cruising, periscope depth, or a little bit below. During the day and at night, we'd come up on the surface and we'd search for the radar.
Okay, were you on the Lamprey until the end of the war?
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, I put her in commission and went out of commission. We came back at the end of the third patrol. Well, the end of the second patrol, we didn't go back to Australia. We went into Subic Bay in the Philippines, which was had recently been captured. And the so-called rest camp was just a couple of Quonset huts off in the swamps that you could rest, but that was about it. And so a lot of the fellas would hitchhike into Manila, or some of them would try to get rides on some of the patrol planes that were going out and looking for Japanese. Or, you know, they'd do just about anything. When they're in Australia, they'd go off into the desert and try to get around the countryside. But there wasn't that much to do in the Philippines. I did get down to Manila. And my brother-in-law happened to be down there with the Army. He was with the Army engineers that were clearing the port of Manila. And so I went down, got a hold of him, met him, and invited him to come on up to Subic Bay and took him out for a ride on the submarine. It's pretty liberal about things. People could bring their friends. When we were in Australia, one of the crew picked up a dog, and we had him with us for the last two patrols and brought him back to the States. The sailors taught him to urinate on some of the officers' shoes.
Oh, jeez.
He never bothered me any. He was a little Australian dingo dog. And brought him back to the States, and I guess the fellow that owned him got him in all right. Mm-hmm. Some of the other boats had kangaroos and parrots and monkeys. Others had dogs. I don't know why they had cats, but they could have had anything. Mm-hmm. So most anything went when you were out there.
Now, you said one of the most memorable events, I guess inspiring events, was the end of the war. Where were you when the war ended?
Well, on our third patrol from Subic Bay, we went back to the Java Sea. And we were lined up to go into a place that was so narrow and crowded, they called it the Bird Bath. And we were going to go in there because it was supposedly a Japanese convoy. There were hardly any big ships left, but this was supposed to be some. Anyway, by that time, we got word that the bomb had been dropped, and so everybody knew the war was over.
What did you think when you heard about that?
I thought that was great, wonderful. Mm-hmm. People nowadays forget that there was still plenty of war going on elsewhere. The Japanese still held the whole Dutch East Indies, and people were getting killed all the time down there. So the submarine that had been built just before us, the Lagarto, actually we'd all been on it for training up in the Great Lakes. And she was lost up in the Siam Gulf just about the time we came out. So many of our crew knew people on that boat. So it was still dangerous, and even though we weren't encountering much, we were going into places that nobody would have thought of going into at that early part of the war. I mean, the idea of chasing sub-chasers and going into places called the Bird Bath. Anyway, we were making an approach on a three-masted schooner when I got the word to cease hostilities. And so we had to let him go. Of course, I was being a communications officer, got the radio message and took it right into the cabin. Mm-hmm.
Now, did you hear about the death? Were you on patrol when you heard about the death of President Roosevelt? Did you hear about that while you were at sea?
Yeah, I guess so. Or was it when did he die?
Prior to the dropping of the bomb.
It was around April, wasn't it?
Well, before that, I was thinking we may not even have been out into the war zone yet.
Okay, I can't think of the last exact date.
No, I don't recall too much about the reaction at that time. Everybody, of course, was sorry to hear about him, though not everybody was that crazy about Roosevelt.
Mm-hmm. Now, when the hostilities ended, you were sent back to the States?
Well, ultimately.
Yes.
Yeah. We were sent back to Subic. We had been scheduled to go back to Perth, and everybody loved Australia. Mm-hmm. A lot of the sailors actually married girls in Australia. But we were sent back to Subic and tied up with, must have been 20 subs all tied up alongside the tender. And waited there for word what to do, and we finally decided some of them would go up to Tokyo and some would go back to the States and some would do. We went back to Pearl Harbor and then back to San Francisco. And we're due for an overhaul, which we waited quite a while in San Francisco Bay, and finally went into Hunters Point Shipyard for an overhaul. And all of this was uncertain as to what was going to happen ultimately, but after we overhauled and had the battery changed and some modifications, they decided to put us out of commission. So we took the boat up to Mare Island and put her in mothballs. And I was there from the beginning to the end.
Now, do you know what the fate of the sub was? Was it eventually scrapped or?
Oh, well, the Lamprey and a number of the other Manitowoc boats were taken out, were brought back into service in, would have been the 50s.
Mm-hmm.
And the Lamprey was given to Argentina. I believe it came to Santa Fe. And it was interesting because at that time I happened to be, by then I had become an engineer and duty officer and I'd been ordered back to Hunters Point. And I was in charge of what they call the sub base, the submarine overhaul activities, and darned if they didn't bring the Lamprey in to be converted and or reactivated and turned over to Argentina.
Hmm.
So I briefly got back aboard just before I left the shipyard.
Okay, after you returned to the States then and...
Well, after the war,
what happened?
We had a point system for being discharged,
yes.
As you probably know. And I didn't have that many points, but I had an awful lot of leave time accumulated because we couldn't take any leave all the while I was out. And so I was just ordered back to home to take the leave, which was back here in, my wife's home was back in Clover, New York, across the river. So we came back there. I think I had about 3 months accumulated leave. While we were there, our daughter was born. And at the end of that, well, wondering what to do, of course, I had been in and out. Well, I wanted to get out. And I thought, I like the Navy. I want to get out. And I had contacted a couple of colleges and took some tests as to what I might be interested in. Anyway, I put in for postgraduate. I said, if I get postgraduate course from the Navy, I will stay in. And at the end of my leave, I was ordered just to report down to Church Street in New York City and wait for the orders. So we were just doing busy work. And what do? I get orders to a new submarine up in Portsmouth. A Spinax, and I hadn't heard anything about the postgraduate. So we went up to Portsmouth and found a place to live and put the new boat into commission. The Spinax was a radar picket, something they developed at the end of the war to warn against the kamikazes. And these radar picket subs were supposed to be out in front. And you had a lot of radar up on deck, radar pedestals here and there. They were monstrous looking things. And they had electronics everywhere in the boat. Every corner they could find, they had crammed something into it. They called it Program Migraine, which... the radar picket conversions. Anyway, this was one of the first ones. But a couple days after it was commissioned, I got orders to MIT. I'd finally gotten one of my postgraduate choices. Actually, it's the one I wanted the least. It was an electronics course. The captain was mad as matter of mind. I mean, I didn't blame him here. They'd ordered me to the boat, and he'd got no use out of me at all. And I was just on her for a couple of days after she went into commission. So I then went to MIT, and Navy sent me to the electronics course there. That lasted something like, 1949, so I was there a little over 2 years. And I got a second bachelor's degree. It was not a master's degree course. But when I got out of that, I was ordered to another submarine, the SeaCat, which was down in Panama. And so we packed up and ultimately were flown down in a cargo plane. Then we had two little children. They put us in this cargo plane with bucket seats along the side. All of the transports were tied up in the Berlin airlift. And of course, during this all of this time, the Navy had been cutting back, way back, and ordered down to the squadron that was based in Balboa on the Pacific side of the Panama Canal. And we flew down in this cargo plane, and in the morning, we'd signed up for a meal, breakfast meal, and in the morning they came by and tossed K-rations to everybody, including the babies. And I was still wearing my blues, because that was the uniform up in where we'd left from Massachusetts. And we got down there, and it was hot as blazes, and got a lift over to the submarine base, and darned it, if the SeaCat was not pulling out, they were just casting, and the captain said, "Jump aboard, jump aboard." And I said, "I can't, we just got here. I haven't even got any clothes." And so the squadron commander said, "No." But they were short-handed. They really needed another officer. And they said, "You stay here long enough to get your household effects, and we'll put you on the next boat going up." Because it was a rather anomalous situation, and they were based on the Pacific side of the Panama Canal, but their operations were all up out at Guantanamo and Key West. So you'd have to go all the way through the canal and go way back up there, and you'd be up there for 2-3 weeks away from your family. Then you come back for a couple of week upkeep. So I went up on another sub, Diablo, and met the SeaCat up in Key West. Went aboard her. I again became communications officer. And electronics and a whole bunch of subsidiary duties. And at the end of the training, what we would do, we were simply acting as a training boat for destroyers at the sonar school. And we'd go out and they'd come out and track us. And it was very simple stuff. Mm-hmm. And very routine and dull. We went back to Panama and got word, well, no, before we even went back to Panama, we got word they're going to close the base in Balboa, which was a logical thing to do, frankly. And the boats were all going to be scattered, and they were not going to have us go back. Well, here we are. Everybody had their family there. As far as my family is concerned, we never did get our household effects unpacked. We did get the car. I guess we went back for one upkeep, and then we're back in Key West again when we got word that we would not go back because the base would be closed. Well, anyway, everybody protested, including the commanding officers. So what they let us do, they let the boats swap crews. And one of the boats that was going to stay took the single man, and the married man went back on the Sea Cat and went back down to Balboa. And we had to conduct our own upkeep, frankly, because the tender had already left. Anyway, we were able to get our families on board an attack transport that they diverted. And it was just an ordinary wartime attack transport.
So what did your wife think about all this?
Well, she'd never been away from New York, and while she was in Panama, I was up in Key West, but her college roommate had married a Spanish fellow from Colombia. And so she took the kids and flew down from Panama to Colombia and saw her roommate and had a kind of an exciting time. We saw a little bit of Panama, but not enough to mount anything. But then she and the kids came back to Key West on this attack transport. And we got there at the worst time of the year, as hot as blazes. This is before you had air conditioning much in the houses. And so we were there almost a year. And then the submarine, well, while we were there, I got over to, we would operate either out of Key West or out of Gitmo, Guantanamo. Mm-hmm. And we visited, the boat visited Havana, and it visited the Bahamas, Nassau, and visited Santiago, Cuba, and of course Guantanamo itself. And the family back in Key West, they just sweltered. Anyway, we got orders to the boat was going to go to Philadelphia and be overhauled and converted into an experimental submarine. And so we packed up and moved up to Philadelphia. And I had a shipyard overhaul, and they put an experimental sonar on board. It was a whole torpedo room. Forward torpedo room was simply gutted. Torpedo tubes were there, but you couldn't get to them from inside. We loaded them from outside because we were supposed to still be able to fire them. Anyway, it was just full of electronics. But during this time I had decided to apply for engineering duty. And while waiting for all that to happen, we went through this yard overhaul and went back to Key West, but my wife and kids stayed up in New York because I was pretty certain that I wasn't going to stay on there much longer. And indeed, that's what happened. I got transferred to an aircraft carrier. I was on an escort carrier, the Palau. This was during Korea. When just before the Korean War broke out, they were cutting the submarine force about in half, and that's when I decided I would want to get into engineering duty, which is what I had always hoped for. So that's my interest lay. And anyway. When the war broke out, of course, they fired the Secretary of Defense, the one that was cutting back everybody, and everything changed. Well, the carrier that I got onto, the Palau, was doing training out of Norfolk. We did not get into the Pacific at all. But we would go out for a couple of weeks, and I was training aviators.
Must have been quite different to go from a submarine to a carrier.
It was, because I'd never been on a surface ship. Yeah. I had no particular knowledge, but fortunately, they put me as electronic officer, which I didn't know something about. In fact, it turned out that on submarines, we were a lot more interested in keeping things going. And things were kind of a little bit run down and sloppy on the carrier, and I was able to get them straightened out and made some improvements and had a pretty good game there. Yeah, that was a different. I made some boo-boos, but finally got my feet on the deck, as it were. I was on the Palau for a year, and it took that long for the for an opening to come up in the engineering duty side. And while I was on the Palau, we were based out of Norfolk, so the family moved there. And I got offer in New York. We were on the way. I guess she was heading up to Boston for yard overhaul. Anyway, they let me off at New York, which was handy enough to me because I always kept my home address in New York. I'd grown up in Beacon, you know, down in Dutchess County, and my wife in Claverick a little farther up, and we used that as our home address all the while I was in the service. So anyway, I got off the Palau and I had orders out to Great Lakes to the electronics supply office. So there was another complete change, something I had never worked in. Turned out to be pretty interesting. It was during the Korean War. We were on a 6.5 day week. Worked all on Saturday mornings. Mm-hmm. So I learned a lot about logistics and supply and did a lot of traveling to companies that were building new electronics equipment where we would, the group I was in charge of would decide what kind of spare parts to buy. And so we were out there for another 2 years, I guess it was. And I finally got orders for what I'd been hoping for all along, which was to the electric boat company in Groton, where they were building the Nautilus. So we moved to Groton, and I was stationed at the supervisor of shipbuilding there for the next, I guess, almost 4 years. So the Nautilus was just getting started, really. We were overhauling and converting. They were building new submarines. They were converting old ones. I got a lot of experience on all different kinds of subs. My duties were on the inspection department, and particularly the electronics inspection, but just to keep an eye on the electric boat company people. They were doing all the real work. The Navy people were there to, you know, to observe and direct, but we weren't the hands-on people. We were inspectors, not workers.
How much had electronics on these submarines changed from the time, like, on the Lamprey to the Nautilus?
Not that well. By the time of the Nautilus, things had changed. The basic radar sets were still pretty much the same, although they were improved models. They were beginning to get some new sonar equipment, which they copied from German models. So a couple of the boats that we were working on, electric boat, were what they called hunter-killer submarines. And they were basically World War II boats, but they were modified with, put a big sonar up in the bow, a great big 8-foot thing. was a long-range detection sonar, so that, of course, was all new to me. They still had some of the older sonar, was simply an improved model of the wartime.
Did you have more transistorized units and less tubes?
I hadn't gotten into transistors yet. They were beginning to get into encapsulated circuits, which were still vacuum tubes, but they were miniature vacuum tubes rather than the big full-size ones. Mm-hmm. And they'd make up a little circuit and then encapsulate it in plastic.
Okay.
And you'd replace the whole circuit. But that was just the latest stuff. And so transistors hadn't really taken over. The Nautilus, of course, was one of a kind, and her skipper wanted everything new. He wanted anything he heard about, and he had enough oomph with Rickover, and he could get what he wanted. So he wants this equipment. Well, that's, you don't need it. Well, we want it. And I put it on, and it was some experimental thing, and it would flood out. Anyway, I was there when the Nautilus went in commission, and stayed there for, well, I didn't. So I'd been on a number of, well, I went out on the Nautilus on one of her sea trials. Not the first one, but I think I was out on the second one. I was out on the deep dive. And on a number of the other subs, I must have gone out on six or eight. Out on the trial dives. So I got a lot of experience, a lot of different types of submarines. And from there, I was ordered to San Francisco, the old shipyard, on the other side of the country again. And this is now what had been the Hunters Point dry docks during the war was now a full-fledged shipyard. And they sent me there to be production analysis officer. Well, here's another. what's that? completely new field. I had to find out what it was about and what my duties were, and it turned out part of this production analysis was controlling the work. You'd estimate the work before ship got in there, break it down into job orders, decide out how much people in the shop. It had to balance the workload against the workforce, basically, and tell the shops how many people they were going to be able to have for the next couple of months. Trying to keep the workload flowing orderly and the yard in balance, so you weren't, we were not trying to make a profit, we were just trying to make sure that we weren't spending any more than we needed to. So that was another complete change. And after a couple of years in that, I was put on one of the ship superintendents on the aircraft carrier, Oriskany, which was in the papers last week. I don't know if you read it. They sank her as a reef, a fish reef off of Florida. I don't know if you noticed it.
No.
There's a picture of it in the paper. Sort of sent going down. While I was on it, we converted her, put the angle deck on it, all new equipment, completely modernized her into a first line carrier. So that was another complete change of experience. That's sort of my whole career has been like that. From there I went down to, I was ordered to Washington to the Bureau of Ships. They were having a big reorganization and I got into anti-submarine work. And then I got back into submarine. From anti-subs back to what they called the submarine desk. And I had to organize what they called a submarine antenna improvement program. of all the things we've been complaining about when I was on the subs were still problems. And we set up a special organization to try to keep the electronics antennas from flooding out, keep them reliable. So I was in Washington for 4 years, and then I was ordered back to Portsmouth Naval Shipyard, where I became the quality assurance superintendent. And you say, what's that? Quality assurance is something that we'd never heard of. We considered, well, all they do is they would test everything, of course, and that was considered quality control. But mostly, we just said, well, we're confident, we've done a good job, we'll take the boat out, and we'll go down deep on it. And, well, a friend of mine was the skipper of the Thresher. I'd known him when we put the Nautilus in commission. He was one of their officers, and I wrote to him. I said, how about taking me out on the Thresher? I'd like to see what it's like on one of these brand new boats. Well, he never answered me, and he never came back. Mm-hmm. And that's how I happened to get to Portsmouth, because I had already been ordered to Newport to a destroyer squadron, where I was supposed to be an electronic officer on the staff. Instead, they shifted me up to Portsmouth to replace a guy that went down on the Thresher. So I became quality assurance superintendent at Portsmouth, and this is when we were going through all of the big subsafe ramifications and trying to figure out what had gone wrong on the Thresher and making all the improvements. So I got into a lot of stuff, x-rays and ultrasonics, all kinds of new things. But that's where my career ended.
Now, is that section that you mentioned in here was classified, all that work?
What did I say about
you that? Just said that we asked if you did any unusual duties. You said it's classified. Was that the kind of work then? And
well, the most of the detailed stuff was either confidential or secret. Mm-hmm. But I mean, the general type of duty was well enough known. But at Portsmouth, it was more of the same. We'd go out on sea trials with the boats once the overhaul was completed. Mm-hmm. They were still building new subs there. This was before they took the shipyards out of the construction business. So by the time I left, things were beginning to go downhill from my point of view. As far as
in what ways?
For one thing, they were starting to close down shipyards in a big way. Mm-hmm. And so good duties were getting scarce. Mm-hmm. And of course, the Navy had built up again during Korea, and now it was going down again. Mm-hmm. There was always a lot of attrition whenever I came up for promotion, and I was considering myself mighty lucky to have gotten where I did, because I was not an Annapolis man. Mm-hmm. And I'd come in through the reserves, and I'd seen an awful lot of my contemporaries fall, fail promotion. And anyway, I was just about, I was up for captain at that time, in 1965, and I really had considerable doubts whether I'd make it. I think I probably came just below the line. Mm-hmm. But anyway, I had always resolved, as soon as I get passed over, I'm going to get out of the service. I'm not going to stick around and wait. You could stay and wait for a couple more times. Promotion, but then I said, no, if they don't want me anymore, that's fine, I'll get out. find a civilian job. So that's what I did.
Okay.
But I have no regrets about my time in the service. I had a wide variety of experience, both afloat and ashore.
How do you think your time affected your life? I mean, you know.
Well, it enabled my family to see all the travel back and forth across the country, see an awful lot of the country. I think all my kids got the travel bug, and they now live all over the country, they spread all over. We enjoyed it. We would look forward when we were going to get orders someplace else. We'd talk it all up in a positive way. Tell us how we went.
Oh, that's okay.
And, you know, tell, hey, great, we're going to go somewhere else. And when we'd get there, we'd immediately see the place. And, you know, we're only going to be there 2 to 3 years because that's a normal tour of duty.
Right.
So we got out to California. We immediately, every chance we got, we'd visit a national park. We'd go here. We saw more of the country than the native people did. And that was true all of our duty stations. And so it was a positive experience.
Did you join veterans organizations after you retired at all?
Not right away. I finally joined the sub-vets. I'm not that much of a joiner. But they now have 2 sub-vets organizations. I belong to both of them. One is the Submarine Veterans of World War II, and that does not accept anybody else except World War II veterans, so it's a dying organization. And they're pretty well combined with the others, which are the U.S. sub-vets incorporated, and they take sub-vets from any place, any and every period. And now the 2 organizations work pretty much in hand in hand. The 2 of them meet. The one I'm with meets down in Kingston, and both of them meet at the same time together. So ultimately, the World War II sub-vets are already talking about closing up and merging into the other.
Do you ever stay in contact with any that you served with?
I still write to several of them. We went back, how long ago it was, maybe it was 10 years or 12 years ago, something like that. We would have submarine reunions. And I actually went back to 4 reunions for the Lamprey, and by then, and both skippers had died, and the fellow that was the chief organizer died. And at the last reunion I went to, there were no more than 6 of us. So I no longer do that. They still do have reunion. Now all of the boats together will have a reunion out at Manitowoc, all the boats that were built out there. I got back to a couple of the Manitowoc reunions, so I haven't been back for at least 5 years. But I keep in touch with a couple of people, but that's about all.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for the interview.
Well, it's been a long interview.